From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In our first half hour today, we talk about the use of mathematical models in public policy with Iowa State University engineer Ross Morrill. Then, investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register, Tom Witowski, will join us to talk about the wild scramble in major college athletics. Yesterday, Colorado announced that it's leaving the Big 12 conference for the Pac-10. Anxiety could rise more today with a pending vote by the Nebraska Board of Regents to consider admission to the Big Ten Conference. We'll ask Tom Witowski to explain what's going on. It all starts right after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in our second half hour, the wild scramble in major college athletics. We'll talk about that with Tom Witowski of the Des Moines Register. Rumors flying left and right of schools ready to bolt from their respective conferences. And we'll have Tom explain that to us in our second half hour. In our first half hour, our focus is on models, not the type who sashay down catwalks, but the type of models that we use to understand how complicated systems work, the type that make mathematical predictions and often become part of public policy debates. My first guest is Ross Morrill, an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at Iowa State University. Morrill believes engineers do have a place in public policy debates, and Morrill's had some firsthand experience. A report he helped write as a postdoctoral researcher at Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs attracted the attention of a New York Times blog, Rush Limbaugh, and Bloomberg Television. Ross Morrill joins us this afternoon from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames. Good afternoon to you, Professor Morrill.
Good afternoon. Thanks very much for having me on.
Now, as I understand it, you develop large-scale computer models of engineering and economic systems that involve governments, corporations, technology, and consumers. What can engineers bring to public policy discussions that others don't?
Well, I think specifically with energy policy, which is the area I work in the most, engineers have a vital knowledge of the technology that's regulated, for example, cars and trucks in the case of our national fuel economy standards. And so they have a very important input into the feasibility or aggressiveness of alternative energy policies. But this is a level of interaction that to some degree is already done at the state level and national level in our country. But more broadly, I think engineers have a useful problem-solving perspective in roughly three ways. First, they're accustomed to using quantitative mathematical models to help make decisions about very complex phenomena. Energy legislation and energy-related regulatory decisions concern a system that's far too complicated for most of us to understand without the assistance of detailed mathematical models. And engineers are used to working with systems and making decisions about systems that are too complicated to understand on their own. Second, engineers often use mathematical models to make predictive assessments of alternative courses of action or options. So currently, when Congress debates energy legislation, they often ask governmental agencies to provide quantitative mathematical assessments of the impacts of a proposed bill on the economy, perhaps on the environment. When the American Clean Energy and Security Act was proposed in 2009, this was the cap-and-trade legislation that made it deeply into the news, the Congressional Budget Office, the EPA, and the Department of Energy each released mathematical models, assessments of the impacts of that legislation. The interesting difference that engineers can bring is that we teach engineering students to use their quantitative modeling skills before they've drafted the bill, so to speak, to evaluate their different options for addressing the problem at hand as early as possible. Finally, engineers are often naturally skeptical of the quantitative models that they use. So models are unfortunately just that, models. They can't tell us exactly what the impacts of a particular policy will be. And too often, I think, the results of quantitative models are implicitly interpreted as exact predictions of policy impacts, at least in the language used by government agencies to the public. You can see this in press releases and other statements to the press. engineers often bring a great critical eye to the models they use, asking what data a certain model is based on, what assumptions have been made in formulating the mathematical relationships that make a specific model, and other questions.
Now, since your area of expertise is energy policy with these models, let's look at a closer look at this. And as we mentioned, as a researcher at Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, you and colleagues studied how hikes in gas taxes could reduce greenhouse emissions from transportation. Now, how did you approach this question, and how did you construct a model?
Sure. Well, we actually used an existing model. So we used what's called the National Energy Modeling System. So this is a very large-scale, complex model that the Department of Energy has used for at least 15 years at this point to prepare what's called the Annual Energy Outlook, and to address specific requests from Congress, both the House and Senate, for analysis on legislative proposals. So we use the National Energy Modeling System actually to assess the impact of several policy approaches for reducing oil consumption and greenhouse gas emissions from the U.S. transportation sector. We first considered a price on emissions of carbon dioxide, or CO2, in all sectors of the economy, not just transportation, and then added on top of that transportation-specific policy options like the fuel tax, as you mentioned. But we also considered stricter fuel economy standards and tax credits for the purchase of several alternative fuel vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
We used this specific model to mimic an analysis that Congress might get if they were to consider these proposals.
Now, in doing so, your results, or what you came up with, the $7 per gallon gas made some caught the eye of many in the media across the country.
It did.
How did that happen?
Well, it's not a stretch to say that $7 a gallon gas would catch people's attention.
Right, right. Any editor or producer is going to say, wow, what's that about?
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure. And this is in part a headline, but, you know, the main conclusions of our study were that, you know, addressing oil consumption and greenhouse gas emissions from our transportation sector will be harder than it looks, or harder than conventional wisdom assumes, and that higher prices, higher fuel prices are going to be essential if we're really serious about taking on sort of aggressive greenhouse gas emissions reduction and oil consumption reductions that are called for, say, by the Obama administration. A lot of people think that's very important, but if we're doing that, we may need higher fuel prices in the long run.
Mm-hmm. So what is the significance of $7 per gallon then?
$7 a gallon was the, you know, again, that's just the quantitative result that comes out of the model that shouldn't necessarily be taken, you know, at face value. But there are a few specific things I should say about those sort of higher fuel prices, especially since they're something people react to, you know, so aggressively and for good reason. So first, the higher fuel prices would certainly have a huge impact, especially for a lot of households with lower incomes. And if it was a serious policy proposal to have higher gasoline or diesel taxes, then, of course, you know, the legislators would pair another measure to mitigate the disproportionate burden higher driving costs would have on those households. This might mm-hmm. be tax reductions, direct rebates, or extensive investments in public transport. We didn't really directly consider a lot of that. Second, the fuel prices in our study gradually increased over a long period of time, over 10 or even 20 years. So $7 a gallon in 2020 or in 2030. So that's a very different sort of thing than what we saw in the summer of 2008, for example, when gas prices almost doubled in the span of a little more than a year.
Mm-hmm.
In that short span of time, we all have very little capability to adjust how and what we drive.
Right.
So that gradual transition is also a very important component of that. But, you know, the bottom line, at least in terms of, you know, what the model contains that says we need higher fuel prices, is that they were the only policy that we considered that directly addressed a persistent growth in the use of personal vehicles over the next 20 years.
So that is the only way, the pocketbook is the only way to get people's attention and change behavior. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's the only thing that was included in the model that affected that change.
I'm
not sure if that's really the only thing that could affect that change, but, you know, some people say yes, some people say no. Europeans, for example, that I've talked to already have such high gas prices. And, you know, though I haven't talked to that many, they say, yeah, it should be higher. Like, if you want to do this, you should have higher fuel prices. But that's something coming from their established perspective.
Mm-hmm. What good does it to come up with a model such as this that comes up with $7 a gallon for gas, extrapolates that when no sort of gas hike would ever be politically feasible in sort of a gas tax?
Well, using models like this to address what it might take to actually achieve reductions that people say in Washington or in various states have said is an important target, reductions in greenhouse gas emissions or reductions in our imports of oil, you can start these things out on the in the debate. So, you know, now people, you know, maybe are talking a little bit about, you know, higher fuel prices.
Mm-hmm. And
I think these models can be used just to sort of get things started.
This model, this $7 a gas, caught the attention of, among others, Rush Limbaugh and Mike Drudge. How did Rush Limbaugh latch onto this? What did he use it for?
Some of the commentary that took this $7 a gallon gasoline result really adopted it out of context and used it for other purposes. So used it to directly attack the Obama administration, even though there was no link between our study and that administration. But that's a danger when you put modeling results, mathematical modeling results, out into the public sphere. They become part of the debate, and people can, you know, be free to adopt them to their ends.
Mm-hmm. What can you do as an engineer, though, when you have these models to prevent them being distorted for political purposes? Nothing, probably, huh?
Very little. So what you can do is when you have opportunities like this or other opportunities to speak to the public yourself, you can hopefully correct misinterpretations. You can put out your own perspective. You can hope that other people think critically about the issues. So one interesting thing that happened with the New York Times blog article, this was the Dot Earth blog that actually originally caught the attention of Mike Drudge and I think Rush Limbaugh, is that a lot of people initially commented after the article very quickly with, you know, very aggressive comments, just attacking the ideas. And, you know, after a while, people started to come in and comment, say, have you read the article? You know, do you know there's no link between the administration and these scientific researchers and so forth? So eventually the comment stream, at least with this one blog article, you know, started to work out a relatively intelligent debate on the issue.
Okay. We'll have to take a short break and come back. Please stay put. Ross Morrill, Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Iowa State University. He works on developing large-scale computer models of engineering and economic systems that involve government, corporations, technology, and consumers. Perhaps you use modeling in your work somehow, and you have to have a question or a story to share with us. 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be right back in just a few minutes. And we're back with ISU Assistant Professor Ross Morrill talking about models, mathematical models to take into account very sophisticated systems and to predict. As a doctoral student at the University of Michigan, Professor Morrill, you develop new theories and numerical methods to analyze the government policies regulating greenhouse emissions and their effects on the auto industry's design and pricing decisions. Tell us about that.
Sure. Most broadly, this line of my research, which started with my doctoral research but continues here at Iowa State, is about including specific firms in their competitive strategy in models of the transportation sector, but in a way that can be generalized to other important energy sectors. For example, electric vehicle technology has existed for some time. I think even one researcher in a paper I've read tracked the technology back to the early 1900s. But only relatively recently have automotive firms and some startups decided to offer hybrids. Shortly, they'll have plug-in hybrids as well as a few all-electrics to mass-market vehicle consumers. So when we're considering transportation policy decisions or indeed national energy policy decisions, it's not enough to think about what technology exists and how it could perform. We also have to understand how competitive enterprises that are profit-driven or have other specific motives will adopt that technology, will tweak it to a particular market, and how they'll present it to a marketplace to really understand the economic and environmental impacts of that technology or a policy that relates to that.
And when you include all those other things, that expanded list of variables and questions, what conclusions do you reach? That we're on the right track, not on the right track, or is that not the right question?
Well, you know, from my perspective, we're still working on it. There are definitely people that have used game theoretic models. This is the field that I work in the most as well, that includes competitive strategy, to, you know, say a gas tax is better than a fuel economy standard. My focus so far is really about developing the mathematical tools that we need to really understand those models that we can then take into validation exercises that would say these are appropriate models of the automotive industry, for example, that could be used for the purpose of developing policy.
I wonder if you can take this, staying on this topic with the greenhouse gases and the emissions and auto industry design, take it out of the theoretical and give us a concrete example where the model really makes a big difference in how we understand a hybrid car, for instance, or an electric car.
Sure. So some researchers already at Duke University have done an empirical study of exactly that, hybrid vehicles. And their question was, how much has the rise up in gas prices from the early 2000s to 2008 impacted the sales of hybrid vehicles? So a direct empirical question, how important was a natural increase in gasoline prices to the diffusion of hybrid vehicle technology? I don't remember the specific numbers, but they felt it was, you know, pretty influential. It could mean $1,000 on the price of a hybrid vehicle, meaning that the raise in gas prices meant that a hybrid vehicle was $1,000 more expensive now because it was desirable than if that rise in gas prices hadn't otherwise occurred. This is the game theoretic model is kind of hidden in this part of the discussion, but it's important to when you want to mathematically account for the impacts of competitive strategy on pricing. That's the only variable they considered, not the design or offering of the hybrid vehicles, but just the pricing of those vehicles. Mm-hmm. Existing models, say like the National Energy Modeling System that I mentioned earlier, used in the Harvard study, doesn't consider competitive effects on pricing, which definitely do exist. It just says, here's this vehicle. It's a hybrid vehicle. Hybrid powertrain costs X number of dollars more than a standard powertrain, so that's the difference in the retail price of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Perry from Galesburg writes an email and asks, did you consider existing speed limits or lower speed limits as part of the model for reducing gas consumption, greenhouse gases?
We did not consider lower speed limits. That sort of detail is not available in the National Energy Modeling System, but people have definitely used the National Energy Modeling System to study policy options that you can't, you know, literally transcribe into the modeling system by saying it would have this impact on fuel economy or it would have this impact on how many miles are traveled.
Mm-hmm. You are working, I understand, to improve how models handle something as complex and as uncertain as the energy industry. For example, the uncertainties of our oil reserves, and we see in the Gulf, of course, we don't know that what our future in oil will be, also coupled with advances in vehicle technology. How do you have a model tackle that when there's so much uncertainty?
Sure. This is an important area of future research. That's why it's hopefully a good area for an assistant professor to be involved in. So there are technical challenges as well as more social challenges for the debate. So technically, you know, we have to decide and understand how we actually quantify those uncertainties, how we put them into a mathematical model, and how the mathematical model treats uncertain quantities. So in addition to the resources and vehicle technology, everybody knows that fuel prices are uncertain. We don't know exactly what they're going to be in a few months or next year or, you know, 5 years down the line. And then after we deal with the technical challenges, there's still going to be the challenge of adopting models with new capability into the public debate. So we have to be able to intelligently debate different policy options, both in Congress or in Des Moines or with each other here on Main Street, explicitly accepting uncertainty that we have about the impacts of different policy options in the future.
When these terribly sophisticated, complicated mathematical models are created, they themselves are not perfect and have errors in them. But then when they move to the spheres of public policy, they are necessarily simplified. Or are they?
Both. So when the National Energy Modeling System, a very complicated model, is used for the analysis of a particular legislative proposal, the Department of Energy will prepare, you know, a condensed report and summary that people will read about the specific results. And I think that's part of what is built into the culture that lends the results to be taken kind of more at face value than maybe they should. But models can also be used, complicated models can also be used to build a qualitative understanding of a system that may be complicated. A professor at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, named John Sturman, has a fantastic example of this in climate change policy. Our global carbon cycle is like a bathtub with both the drain and the faucet open. Certain activities absorb CO2 from the atmosphere, acting like a drain, while other activities add CO2 to the atmosphere, acting like the faucet. But unfortunately, Professor Sturman has shown in some surveys that it's difficult for people to make the effective decisions for regulating such a system without the assistance of models. And so what he's done is built simple computer tools to demonstrate the policy implications of this bathtub analogy to key policymakers like Senator John Kerry and others. And so the purpose of the software, you know, that he developed was the opposite of the National Energy Modeling System, to have something that could quickly return results that demonstrated a very specific complex behavior that it was difficult for people to intuitively understand.
We have just a couple minutes left, and I wonder if you can give us some hints, because we're not, most of us are not engineers and create mathematical models. Some hints for us as everyday consumers of the media when we see a model turn up in a news report. How should we see that? What is the appropriate questions we should ask ourselves and the skepticism we should bring to it?
Well, it's difficult to really critically evaluate models without a lot of specific expertise in the area that they're developed in. I think the one thing that might be most useful and that could be done by anybody is to make the best attempt that you can to look at the variety of modeling results that are available to you. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like the policy debate tends to latch on to specific results that, you know, promote a particular agenda, and then to not consider the other results. Very often with important issues, there are a number of organizations or in the government or outside of the government that have done modeling. So if you can find, you know, different conclusions and try to weigh the different results that you see, then at least you might have a spectrum of the possible outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Is that one of the things that drives you most, that drives you, bothers you the most in the media, is that models are used as a sort of a certainty out there?
That's definitely one of many things that bother me about the way the policy debate is carried out in the public sphere. I think that's very important, and that's another thing that engineers and scientists often bring in. Scientists look at different models, but don't reject them on the basis of their conclusions. They reject them on the basis of what they do or don't contain.
Professor Morrell, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for sharing your work with us. Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering at ISU, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And when we come back, we'll look at the wild scramble in major college athletics. What's going on there? We'll find out from Tom Witowski, investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Monday on this program, with the World Cup underway in South Africa, the first match being played within the last hour or so, we talk about Iowa's ties to the world's most popular sport. The head coach of Iowa's Premier League soccer team, the Des Moines Menace, Lori Calloway will join us. Also, his native South African assistant and his South African midfielder will be on our program Monday. We'll talk about what kind of foothold soccer has in the Iowa sports landscape. Also, we'd like to have you tell us if you've caught World Cup fever Monday on the Exchange at noon. Right now, we're also talking about sports as we continue into our second half hour of the program. The wild scramble is on in major college athletics. Rumors flying left and right of schools ready to bolt from their respective conferences to greener pastures and the possible formation of super conferences. Yesterday, Colorado was the first shoe to fall, announcing that the Boulder school is leaving the Big 12 conference for the Pac-10. Anxiety could rise more today with a pending vote by the Nebraska Board of Regents to consider Cornhusker admission to the Big 10 conference. Imagine that. Joining us now to help us make sense of what's going on, Tom Witowski. He is an investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register, joining in us from his office at the Des Moines Register. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon.
So tell us, what is going on here and why?
Well, it depends on what level. I mean, this is almost sort of like a video game where you go from one level to the next level to the next level. And because of that, it's one of those kinds of stories that first will speed up and then slow down and then speed up and then slow down. Essentially, what we have is underneath all of this, I think, is several of the conferences, the Big Ten in particular, the Pac-10, as the other one, have decided that they need more market share. I guess that's the business term for it, where they want to expand the number of folks within the footprint of their conferences. And the reason that they want to do that is simply because of television sets and the new development of a conference network that is basically paid for by cable subscriptions. So it's a situation where they are actually trying to expand the number of television sets based on the subscriptions that they will get paid for on a monthly basis. Inside the footprint of the Big Ten, Big Ten's conference, the Big Ten network gets about anywhere from 60 to 70 cents per subscriber per month. Mm-hmm. Outside, they get about a dime. Well, if you add on more markets, or you add value in terms of, like, Nebraska, as an example, if Nebraska joins, they don't have really all that many television sets, but what they do have is Nebraska fans all over the country. Mm-hmm. That would permit the Big Ten Network to basically increase their fee outside of their footprint and make money that way. And in terms of the Pac-10, they are underway in terms of renegotiating a television contract. They are also talking about setting up their own network, and so they're basically trying to do the same thing. It's all basically an attempt to increase market share.
Mm-hmm. So if, let's say, Nebraska is admitted to the Big Ten Conference, does that mean one of the other Big Ten universities has to leave?
No. That's not even being contemplated as far as I know. In fact, actually, there's discussion that among Big Ten folks, and everybody has to understand that this is, we glean bits and pieces every time we talk to somebody about what they are talking about. Ultimately, there is discussion that the Big Ten could expand to 14 or even 16 teams.
But still be called the Big Ten.
Yeah. People, you know, think that folks in college can't count that high. or can't get their numbers straight. Trust me, they do get their numbers straight. That's what this is all about. But it's a brand name.
Okay, so if I'm understanding you right then, Tom, that what's been building up to this point, the thing that we've sort of let loose here is the evolution of these cable networks that are conference cable networks, like the Big Ten Network.
Exactly.
And so it's revolving around money. These have been developing over the years, and now we've reached a critical mass where things are starting to tumble.
Well, basically, the Mountain West Conference has had its own network as well, but since they don't have near the kind of population numbers, it hasn't been all that noticeable. The Big Ten, when they started this back in 2007, it was a huge experiment, and quite frankly, they weren't even really sure it was going to work. They thought it was, and that's why they went ahead with it. And the Fox Sports Network, decided that they wanted to bankroll it. And it was an experiment. As it has turned out, it has turned out to be very successful. If you remember, a couple years ago, there were the big fights with the various cable providers over whether or not they were going to, A, pay what they thought at the time was an exorbitant fee, and B, were they going to put it on their basic offering. And if you remember, there was quite a lot of debate over that for about 6 to 8 months, and they finally made all the deals with all the different cable providers, and since then, it now makes money, and now it probably makes a good chunk of money for all the member universities who are getting, my guess is, anywhere from $7 to $10 million a year, from the network, and basically are hoping to get more by expanding into possibly New York, New Jersey. There's even been some talk of going out to Maryland, into Tennessee. So it's one of those kind of things where it is basically straight business. You're trying to get as big a market share as you possibly can.
Tom Witowski is an investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register. He's been covering this scramble among major college athletics, people bolting, well, specifically Colorado, bolting from its conference, the Big 12. Excuse me, and we'd like to get our Tom. We'd like to get our listeners in on this conversation. What are your thoughts on this college athletics realignment? Is an expanded Big Ten conference appealing to you? What about the Big 12? What about Iowa State University? How will it affect them? What are your feelings? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Can you imagine the Cornhuskers in the Big Ten, for instance? This is, it's interesting. Political heavyweights, Tom, are voicing their opinions on this, jumping in. We have statements from Senators Harkin, Grassley, the governor. What's at stake for them?
Well, don't ever underestimate a politician's willingness to get into a controversy where they can look like the good guy. That said, depending on who you're talking about, whether it's Governor Culver or the Senator Grassley and Senator Harkin, on the federal level, I think that there are a couple of serious questions that need to be at least examined as these conferences try to do this, and that is, these outfits are nonprofits that are supposedly designed or have their nonprofit status to enhance education. And I think it's gotten to the point now, given the business models that these conferences are adopting, and that these academic institutions are approving, that the question needs to be raised is what's the educational benefit to all this? And that's what Senator Grassley is raising in terms of these conferences, is that if these conferences are going to collect these kinds of large amounts of money, what is the educational benefit? And people will be able to should discuss that in probably in an in-depth way. One of my old saws is that as I've covered these issues for the last 20 years, is that every time I call it education, those on the other side call it business, and then when I call it business, they call it education. And as a result of that, it is a dilemma that is consistently, that is a thread throughout all of the debates over, is college sports too big? Does it have anything to do with academics? I mean, there are benefits to that these universities are getting, or at least the boosters are getting. You know, their contributions to athletic departments are deductible as an educational contribution. Their suite leases so that they can sit at Kinnick Stadium or a Jack Trice Stadium and watch a football game. Their suite lease is about 80% tax deductible. Now, it's I think a legitimate question. Is that appropriate, particularly in an age when you have coaches, and coaches are making millions of dollars, yet players basically are limited solely to their scholarship, their books, and their room and board? So there are some serious questions in all of this. Now, can Congress really step in and stop this? No. But I also think that at a certain point, a school like Iowa State raises these questions simply to maybe try to slow down the process that seems to have enveloped the entire country over this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like it's a race to get to the nuclear option, which would be a complete breakup of the Big 12,
mm-hmm.
Possibly breakups of other conferences, and a real consolidation of economic power within four or five conferences.
And right now it looks like, for instance, Iowa State, President Jofre has weighed in on this as well. Could Iowa State be left holding the bag once the music stops and the other schools have found conferences that Iowa State's in a less beneficial position?
That could happen. It's something that nobody wants to talk about. It is something that Jamie Pollard and President Jofre obviously know has a tremendous amount of downside to it. There were these reports that there might be a mass exodus of Big 12 members to the Pac-10, Texas, Texas A&M, Texas Tech. Colorado has already gone, as well as Oklahoma and Oklahoma State. If that would happen, essentially, unless the Big 12 could find other members, the conference would dissolve. If it would dissolve, then Iowa State would suffer a pretty substantial loss in revenue. By that, I mean maybe $4 to $5 million a year, at least at first blush, if they went into a lesser conference, as well as a bit of a blow to athletic prestige. Also in that group would be Kansas, which has one of the most powerful and traditional basketball programs in U.S. sports history, Kansas State, Missouri, and Baylor. So it's it is a high-stakes game that's being played right now. The only problem is that nobody really – it is like a poker game. Nobody knows what really is in each other's hand, and nobody's tipping it very quickly or easily.
We have about 10 minutes left with Tom Witowski, investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register. Let's try to get to as many calls as we can in the remaining few minutes. Rick is in Iowa City. Good afternoon, Rick. Rick, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Yes, my question is, let's take Colorado, since they're the only one that has officially moved. Is that just for the large revenue sports like football and basketball, or will the Colorado golf team and the women's gymnastics team be traveling up to Washington and out to California to participate?
Mm. Good question, Rick. Do you move lock, stock, and barrel once you change conferences?
Absolutely. That's sort of the attraction for, in terms of recruiting athletes, is that they are full member. They will be full members of that conference. So, yes, the golf team is going to have to go to Pullman and up to Seattle, and as well as to Tempe and Tucson. So, it's one of those things where they are going to probably increase their travel budgets. They're going to have to, but on the other side, they're hoping that more revenue is going to come in as they renegotiate this television contract.
Okay, an email from Jeremy in Ames asks, haven't large conferences tried to make a go in past years and failed? I feel it will hurt the structure of college football, writes Jeremy.
Well, one of the things that has happened, and everybody agrees to this, is that the growth of these conferences does have to do with the development of these networks and just the amount of attention and amount of money that they can get out of various television networks. Television is diverse now as ever, and what has been discovered is that sport is one of the things that drives people to certain stations or certain networks, and that's why they do it. I mean, the success of ESPN, I mean, you know, 20, 30 years ago when ESPN started, everybody thought it's crazy. The 24-hour sports station, are you nuts?
Now, right? We can't imagine our lives without it, even the second network.
Well, you know, you mentioned the World Cup. I'd love to see their numbers on the World Cup game this morning. I mean, the thing is that compared to what the kind of attraction soccer used to get in this country, now that what it gets, partially because of ESPN, it is remarkable.
Okay, Bruce is in Solon. Hi, Bruce.
Hello. Yes, I would like to use a sports metaphor, just drop back a little bit further and ask the reporter to comment on how the failure of the legislature and the citizens of Iowa to support Regents institutions, and I'm sure this is true in other schools in the Big Ten, for example, connects to this business model that he talked about. I mean, given that the University of Iowa, where I'm most closely aligned and being in Solon, the university just is not having sufficient revenues from state appropriations and from the citizens of the state to really keep its education program going. So it has to rely on sports funding and scrambling and through this business model to attract resources. So these are realignments, really, if Iowa State alumni don't like it, they need to point to themselves and ask, well, why aren't we supporting our Regents institutions satisfactorily?
Tom Witoski, would that have made a difference had the universities not had the cuts over the last few years, or would it have been the same deal?
I disagree. For the most part, and there have been studies done on this issue left and right, athletics doesn't really bring in all that much money in terms of contributions to universities per se, and there is very little transferring of money from athletic departments in general. Now, this is generally speaking. Generally speaking, most athletic departments in major college athletics take money from the institution, not give it money. Now, there are exceptions. Iowa is a school that depending on how the accounting is done, takes very little, almost no money at all from their general fund. On occasion, coaches will make large contributions back to the school, but there very seldom is a transfer of large amounts of money from athletic departments back to a school's general fund. The issue of taxpayer support for education at the universities is a very real one. I think you might be able to suggest with some validity that successful athletic programs might tend to hide the need for better support for the academic side of it. But in terms of marketing and that type of thing, in other words, if the team's doing really well and is fully funded, then obviously the school's doing well. Well, that's not necessarily the case.
Outside of ISU and the UI, are there other schools in Iowa potentially affected by this conference realignment?
I don't think so. I mean, there's been a lot of more or less facetious comments that possibly Iowa State should go into the Valley, which is where the University of Northern Iowa plays. But that's not going to happen. At least I really would tend to doubt it. That would be incredibly drastic change. So in that sense, neither UNI or Drake, which is also a Division I school, would be directly affected. Now, the other, in using my metaphor of a video game, it has been suggested to me that, like, the fifth or sixth level of this would be a complete breakup of the NCAA, and that 48 to 60 schools would form their own association, which would have its athletic, would have its own playoff and in both basketball and football. And the other, if there were 60, that would leave 240 other schools like Drake, like UNI, out to basically do whatever it is that they could put together. Now, like I said, that's level 4, level 5, or level 6. So there are some people who think that just might happen.
We have just a couple minutes left. Let's get a quick question and answer. Chris in Coralville is with us. Hi, Chris.
Big Ten football. If Nebraska joins the Big Ten, will we see a playoff championship? And also, what's the timeline for implementation? If they join the Big Ten, when is that going to happen? When are they going to show up on the schedules?
I think a playoff is very likely, though it's not necessarily something that has to happen. It would be up to the conferences, the conference presidents, to make that decision. As for timing, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, we're a little, it's, again, people want answers to a whole lot of questions to which there are no answers just yet, but there will be. My guess, it would be about 2 years. At least that's what I've been told, or estimates that have been made to me. There has to be a wind down, and then obviously, the athletic directors at all the different schools have to start rescheduling everything and trying to figure out, what the divisions would look like, what kind of scheduling is going to be taken. It's not an easy process. If I remember correctly, it was 2 years after Penn State was announced as joining the Big Ten that they went in.
Tom, we have just a minute left. What will you, as an investigative reporter covering this for the Des Moines Register, be watching most closely in the coming hours and days?
Unfortunately, it's going to be watching the state of Texas. The University of Texas, Texas A&M, Texas Tech, Oklahoma State sort of hold the key to whether or not we're going to level three or level four. If they remain in the Big 12 and go out and try to get a couple other schools to join so that they can go back to having a playoff, then I think very little will happen, except with the possible exception of the Big Ten looking eastward into Big East country. If, on the other hand, that those schools go to the Pac-10, I think that there is no school, no conference going to be safe, because they're all going to start grabbing and negotiating, and there will be winners and there will be losers. And I couldn't tell you how that's going to happen. So I think folks that are really interested in this need to put your eyes on Texas.
Okay.
As difficult as that might be.
Tom Witowski, thank you very much. I hope you have a few moments, too, in your coverage to give a look at what's happening with the World Cup.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a big World Cup fan. Tomorrow's game between England and the U.S. ought to be just a real fun thing to watch.
Tom, thanks for joining us. Tom Witowski of the Des Moines Register. Thank you.
Thank you.
A reminder again that Monday for sports fans on The Exchange, we'll talk about Iowa's ties to the world's most popular sport as the World Cup is underway in South Africa. The head coach of Iowa's Premier League soccer team, the Des Moines Menace, will be with us. Also his native South African assistant and his midfielder. Have you caught World Cup fever? Join our conversation Monday right here on The Exchange. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins, Jeff Schmidt, and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.